Pete, I deeply appreciate your mentioning my books. I desperately need the revenues, and can't tell you how I appreciate that. You know, if you're presumptuous enough to write a book as a businessman, you have to be prepared to get roasted. And my favorite roaster is Ted Sorensen, President Kennedy's assistant. And on one of my earlier books, he said about my book, "This is a book that once you put it down, you will not be able to pick it up." On my last book, he said, "We're here to anoint Peterson into sainthood." He said, "When I think of him, I think of St. Paul," he said, "the dullest town in America." About the book Grey Dawn, he renamed it The Grey Yawn. So beware if you're a business person writing books. As Pete has pointed out, I am an American dreamer. I did start taking cash at this restaurant at the age of 8. And Pete, when at the end of 25 years he closed the restaurant, he couldn't find the key to the front door because it had never been closed 1 minute for 25 years. And he spent much of his life there. Because I am an American dreamer, I'm very concerned that the American dream may not be there for my 5 kids and 9 grandchildren. And this is the first time in history that both children and their parents, by a majority vote, do not believe they are going to do better than their parents did. If that happens, it would change this entire country. And I believe one of the major challenges, or sets of challenges, are these undeniable, unsustainable, and untouchable challenges that I'll talk a bit about tonight. This is not going to be an inspirational, charismatic speech, I can assure you, for 2 reasons. First, I have negative charisma. In the second place, I am a great believer in the concept that an informed democracy is the best democracy. But I think Americans have been misinformed and disinformed by our politicians who have come to conclusion that the American people cannot take the plain, hard truth. They also believe that it is not only politically incorrect to ask us to make sacrifices, but that it is politically terminal to their career. I do not accept that basic notion. Now, when I set up this foundation, many of my questioning friends said, "What makes you think you can make a difference?" And I said, "I don't know if we can make a difference or not." And no doubt many are saying it's a very presumptuous assumption that you can tackle some of the challenges I'm going to talk to you about and believe you can make a difference. But I was presumably educated at the University of Chicago. And there was a great Nobel Prize winner once who said something there that has stuck with me ever since. He said, "If you have no alternative, you have no problem." And as I thought about that, and I thought about how I would feel on my deathbed about my passing life, and how I would feel if I felt very deeply that this country is challenged at its very core, and I didn't do anything about it. And I concluded that that was no alternative at all. Now, something else played a role in my billion-dollar decision that Pete referred to. There's a story about Kurt Vonnegut, the great novelist, and Joe Heller. And they're at a palatial mansion in the Hamptons. And Vonnegut looks at Heller and says, "Joe, doesn't it bother you that this guy makes more money in a day than you made selling Catch-22 all over the world?" And Heller says, "No, because I've got something this guy doesn't have." And Vonnegut looks at him and says, "Joe, what could you possibly have that this guy doesn't have?" And Heller said, "I know the meaning of enough." And as I thought about that, I had more than enough, so it wasn't really a very difficult decision. I said I was going to comment on some challenges that are undeniable and unsustainable. I was in the Nixon White House, and we had a Nixon humorist there. The Democrats in this audience probably find the idea of a Nixon humorist an oxymoron, but he really was a very funny man. And one day he said about sustainability, if something's unsustainable, he says, it tends to stop. And he said, if you don't like that one, if your horse dies, I suggest that you get off the horse. Well, we're behaving as though we can ride this horse that we're riding indefinitely. Now, this foundation has picked three challenges that are unsustainable, in my opinion. The first are entitlements, Social Security and Medicare, basically. The second is our balance of payments deficits and our foreign borrowing and our lack of savings. And the third is our health care costs, about which much is being said and very little is being done. On entitlements, you hear a lot about the $11 trillion public debt. What you do not hear about are the unfunded promises and liabilities that are much, much larger than that. Social Security is $7 trillion. Medicare is $38 trillion. Our total liabilities are some $56 trillion in today's dollars. How much is that? Because it's a boggling number. It's $485,000 of hidden debt per American household. It's four times the size of this entire economy. It is more than the net worth of all households in America. In other words, we owe more money than we own. Now, if we were to try to solve this problem, meet these obligations with taxes, payroll taxes would have to double. Now, I would call that gross representation, taxation without representation. Many people say, well, let's just get rid of those damn Bush tax cuts. That'll take care of these entitlement problems. Well, the Bush tax cuts amount to 1% of the gross domestic product of this country. The entitlement spending increases, just the increases alone from here on, are 9%. In other words, nine times more than the entire Bush tax cut package. Now, there are those who believe in the supply side who say, well, we can grow out of these obligations, so relax and enjoy it. I asked some experts to compute how fast we would have to grow in real terms in order to meet these obligations through growth. It turns out that we'd have to grow in double digits in real terms, or about four or five, six times as fast as we've ever grown in history. Now, some politicians say, well, what are you concerned about? The politicians are telling me that the Social Security Trust Fund will take care of everything for 40 or so years, so relax and enjoy it. I've taken a habit of collecting oxymorons ever since Time magazine referred to me as the most powerful Secretary of Commerce since Herbert Hoover. In the first place, given what happened to Herbert Hoover, I wasn't sure I fully understood the reference. But in the second place, the Social Security Trust Fund, I'm sorry to tell you, is an oxymoron. It should not be trusted and it's not funded. There is nothing there but liabilities. Now, for those of you who believe that if we got rid of the tax cuts and we got rid of the earmarks and we ended the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, that would take care of these problems. That only would take care of 15% of these obligations. Let's move on to the second challenge, the balance of payments and savings deficits. Because we consume so much in America and we save so little, we're in the position of having to borrow that money from others, from foreign sources. How much are we expected to be borrowing? I asked this Peterson Institute of International Economics if they would do a series of scenarios of what our foreign debt would look like if we persisted in our current path. I'd give you the numbers, except I don't want to give you a serious systemic digestive problem. But I'll quote from one sentence from their report. The projected path is so unsustainable and so dangerous that a crisis would virtually be certain to occur long before the U.S. reached such a painful point of reckoning. So one of the great challenges we face is the quantity of the financing that will be required by the debts and deficits that we're building and where we would get that money. I read a very good article in the National Journal that I wish you would all take a look at if you're interested in this. But they indicate that the estimates that most experts have, if anything, are an underestimate. Now, what are the various scenarios about these massive foreign debts that make this wonderful country look like a third world country if we permit it to happen? Paul Volcker, the famed chairman of the Federal Reserve, believes the odds are 75% if we don't change our ways of a dollar crisis within 5 years. Now, he refers to that as the hard landing. And what is a hard landing? The dollar falls suddenly and sharply. Interest rates rise very substantially. Inflation goes up very substantially with very low growth. Now, if we had more savings at the national level and at the personal level, our country would not be exposed to these really major risks. And as you all know, or perhaps you've forgotten, we used to be one of the biggest savers in the world. And in recent years, we are the lousiest saver in the world and have even had negative savings rates. So if we're going to rescue our economic future, America is going to have to learn to save more. And finally, no serious discussion of challenges that I consider unsustainable are the healthcare costs. Now, there's a lot being said about healthcare these days, and the politicians' triumph was saying that these programs are going to be deficit neutral. Well, even if these new programs were deficit neutral, they are doing nothing about the underlying problem I mentioned earlier, the $38 trillion of Medicare unfunded promises and liabilities. We spend twice as much per capita as the rest of the developed world, and by most criteria, our health outcomes are not as good. We are racing toward 20% of the GDP, threatening the very competitiveness of our economy. Now, in the current debate on healthcare reform, it is said that the healthcare costs were a prime objective, but as I analyze it, they are doing very little about some of the major causes of the healthcare cost crisis in America. Recently, I wrote a column for the Financial Times, and I pointed out 10 cost drivers that are being ignored. And I won't bore you or take you through all of them. I'll just mention a few of them. One of them is the utterly perverse system in Medicare called fee-for-service. We pay for the procedures, we pay for the visits, we pay for the tests, we pay for the surgery. The consumer has no stake at all, and as far as he's concerned, it's free. Well, the effect is what you might expect. If the providers have an incentive to do more and the consumer doesn't care, you would expect a huge increase in the number of such procedures. For example, we have 5 times the CT scans as Germany. We have 5 times as many coronary bypasses as they have in France. So until we reform that fee-for-service procedure, we aren't going to be attacking one of the great drivers. Another one is the great variation from one area to the other. For example, we have states or regions in America that have 6 times the back operations as in other areas, and 6 times the prostate removals. Now, I know we have red states and blue states, But am I to believe that we had bad prostate states and bad back states? It's ridiculous. And yet we tolerate with a very benign attitude these enormous differences in costs. We're the only developed country in the world that has no budget. It's an open-ended cost-plus budget. Now, all of us have learned to live with budgets, and it forces us to make choices. But what's been happening is because we don't have a budget, the entitlements, the Medicare, for example, has exploded in recent years. And to show you how it affects the true investments, and where better place than in Cambridge to remind you of these, 40, 50 years ago, the government used to spend 5% of its budget on research and development. And out of that research came the internet, just to take one such example. That number is now less than 2%. 30%, roughly, of Medicare is in the last year of life. Now, we have seen some very dramatic examples of the complexity of this issue, you know, with Terry Schiavo, which you'll recall a few years ago, and most recently people talking foolishly, I think, about death panels. But we've got to face the fact that we spend significantly more than the rest of the world does on heroic intervention in the last months of life. Now, I don't intend to get into all the issues involved here, but just to show you what can happen here if we start thinking about it. There's a town in South Dakota where 95% of the people have signed living wills. In that area, their costs have dropped 20% on the last 2 years of life. But at the moment, we don't even discuss this very important subject because it raises questions that are profound and very difficult. Is it the government's obligation to prolong life indefinitely, or is it only to prolong life as long as there is a reasonable quality of life can be maintained? Should the government be responsible for the very costly heroic interventions, or should these be the responsibility of the individual taxpayer? These are just examples of the difficulty of the questions that we have not confronted and must confront. All right, so much for the three challenges that we're focusing on. What do we do about them? First, there are many dimensions. We can't run away from the fact that all of the choices will be difficult. They will often require us to make some shared sacrifice. But the good news is there are many sensible and workable proposals that also protect the truly needy. So the problem isn't so much the proposals. The problem is the political will of doing something about it. The one other piece of good news is that the public is now far, far more aware of their concerns about our fiscal future than I can recall in the last 25 years. Now, several ingredients will be required if we're going to come up with an answer. Presidential leadership is utterly essential. But just as essential is bipartisanship. I was brought up in Nebraska, and we used to hunt for pheasants and turkeys. And we used to talk about the turkey shoot phenomenon, that poor turkey that lifted its head got shot off. If a politician mentions a reform, whether it's on Social Security, Medicare, or whatever, and he does it alone, he's likely to get his head shot off. So it's important to put it in a bipartisan concept. Our foundation is going to work very importantly on trying to educate, motivate, and activate the American people to do something about these problems. Now, it's easy to blame the politicians, and a very interesting thing has happened to America. Those of you who know a lot more than I do about American history will recall that the concept that the founders had was that the congressman, for example, would go to Washington for brief periods during the year and be there only for a limited number of years until they'd achieve some objectives. The difference today is they're viewed by most of our elected representatives as careers. So their focus is not on the next generation, but rather on the next election. Now, ultimately, it is we, the people, who are going to have to make it safer for the politicians to do the right things. But if you look at the political landscape, the future in general, and the youth in particular, are not represented, or we need a new special interest that needs to be created of the general interest, a special interest of the future, a special interest of our kids and our grandkids. Now, this country in times past has been remarkably resilient, and I want to remind you of the greatest generation and what they did after the Second World War. Recall that we had public debt much, much higher than it is now, 120% of the GDP. And what did they do? But in a period of about 30 or 40 years, they paid down that debt, they launched the GI Bill, they launched the largest infrastructure program in the history of America, and they launched the Marshall Plan, and they paid for all of these things. So we have done it before, and there's no reason that we can't do it again. The question before us, therefore, is, will it take a crisis to get us to act? And if we do require a crisis, and I pray that we do not, it will be an immensely costly crisis. And in my opinion, the crisis is most likely to be in the foreign exchange markets, where the foreigners lose confidence in our ability to manage our fiscal affairs and refuse to lend us this money except at very high rates. So avoiding the crisis is one of the main focus of this foundation. And we're going to, just to take one aspect of our program that might interest you, we are going to focus a good deal of our young on the young. I don't know if you remember that old joke of the philosophy class, where the professor says to the kids, which is worse, ignorance or apathy? And some kid from the back of the class says, I don't know and I don't care. Well, we're going to have to make them care and make them aware. And I'm the poorest person in the world to present this program, but we have a really major effort in the digital era. I don't even do emails. So when I hear these people talking about YouTubes and MySpace and Twitter and all this sort of thing, I haven't any idea what they're talking about. So I delegate that to others. We're on MTV in a major way, which reaches young college. We're developing video games of all kinds and so forth. Now, we talked about the American dream. I have a dream that we would be able to create an organization that we might call the American Association of Young People, the AAYP. There's something now called the AARP that you're all aware of. It's 39 million members who vote strong, who vote a lot, who lobby a lot, who call a lot, who use every legitimate weapon available to get their programs in. And their program usually can be described by one word or three words: I want more. So we're going to need to develop a movement in this country of people who understand that we're going to have to get by less in this public arena. I have a dream. I sound like Martin Luther King. I didn't have any such pretensions. But I have a dream of seeing 50 or 100,000 young people marching on Washington and saying, in the spirit of that network movie, I met her in hell and I don't intend to take it anymore. But we're going to have to do something of that sort. What do we do first? We had to get a leader, and we were able to recruit Dave Walker, who was Comptroller General of the United States. You've met him, Lou. He knows as much about these subjects as anybody I know. My wife refers to him as an oxymoron. I asked her what she meant by that. She said, he's a charismatic accountant. Let me close on this note. There was a German theologian named Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and he once said the ultimate test of a moral society is is the kind of world it gives to its children. Now, that may not come convincingly from an investment banker these days to utter a tone of morality, but at bottom, that is exactly what it's all about. So I say to all of us, we have to get off of our respective butts, if I may say that, and we must make it safer for politicians to do the right thing. And we should make it unsafe for them to continue to do nothing and slip the bids to our kids. So I know this is all very daunting and perhaps disturbing, but I ask myself again, do we have any alternative but to try? Thank you all very much.